We have a rather challenging world as we sit here today. The aftermath of Harvey for most of us, of course. The forest fires in the West, which we've not even heard a great deal about because of the other things that are going on. The potential for nuclear bombs, though we don't necessarily expect them to be launched by the rogue nation of North Korea, especially possibly against their neighbor in the South. Do you realize that Seoul, Korea, sits only about 15 minutes south of the demilitarized zone across Korea, and that North Korea could easily take out virtually the entire city with some of the very rockets they are now firing into the ocean? Whether they want to do that remains to be seen. Of course, they were all relatives at one time. There were no doubt many people who had family in both parts of Korea, just as it was in the divided Germany after World War II, but now it's been 70 years or so, and so many of those families have not known each other, have not carried on any relationship, and consequently there may not be a lot of hesitation on the part of the North, particularly with the leader being as self-important as he is to launch an attack against South Korea. And now, of course, domestically we have Hurricane Irma bearing down on the entire state of Florida, and the path, as I looked before leaving the house today, was still pretty much straight up through Florida, although it looks like it may make landfall actually on the west coast around Tampa or just below Tampa and come up through that way, whereas Miami would be on the dirty side and on the edge of the heaviest winds, but will probably take a pretty good hit, as will all of Florida, as the storm goes through, unless God decides to hold it. And of course, my prayer was yesterday, today, and will be as these things continue through hurricane season, that God look at the situation and determine what His will is and what His purpose. I mean, He knows what His will is, but in these situations, if God is not bringing the storms, which I suspect He is not, then God certainly can determine where and how they go and could hold them back if He chose to. And it is entirely in God's hands, and all we can do is be reminded that that's the case and put these things in God's hands, even as we did a couple of weeks ago as Harvey came ashore. One of the news anchors on the national network last night said there are scores of disasters all across this country today. Pretty amazing statement. He rattled off four or five, including the ones I've just mentioned. But he said there are disasters raging all across this country today. That's a pretty powerful statement, and I'm not sure where he got his scores number. It might be accurate, but at least he was recognizing that everywhere you turn, there is a problem, and it is not a very pretty world to look at. Now, we don't always know when God is doing something and when God is simply allowing something to happen until sometime later. Maybe we never know. In some cases, we can look back at the massive hurricane that hit Florida in 1992, Hurricane Andrew, which did massive damage and actually did a lot of damage to the homes of brethren at that time, because we had many, many more thousands of brethren in Florida. And we could say, did God do that or did God not do that? You know, and in most cases, we prefer to believe God did not do it, because many brethren were negatively affected. On the other hand, we can be negatively affected and not destroyed. Sometimes that negative experience is a trial for us to learn and grow by and have an outgoing concern for others who might be less blessed. But God could do it. I want to go back to Leviticus chapter 18 here to sort of start the thinking process. I hope that the somewhat of an overview, but with some specifics today, will be helpful to us in thinking about these things and even how to pray about them. Leviticus chapter 18. My fingers have somehow developed a surface that won't turn pages. Leviticus 18, verse 28. Let me back up. I knew I had to do that, but I couldn't remember where. Verse 26, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments and shall not commit any of these abominations. He's listed those that some of the nations of Canaan had committed. You shall not commit any of these abominations, either any of your own nation or any stranger who dwells among you. So he's telling Israel, your way of life and your environment is going to have to be different. For all these abominations the men of the land have done who were before you, and thus the land is defiled. Lest the land, so he says, you don't do that, lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it. If you're reading the King James, it says spew you out. It's the same word really as Laodicea back in the book of Revelation. Lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. Now, keep in mind that while God says it vomited them out, in reality, he told the Israelites that he was going to drive them out and they would have to drive them out. So it was a cause and effect, but it didn't just happen because of the way they lived. It happened because of the way they lived and then God's intervention to change the environment and to bring Israel into that land and teach them how to live a totally different way so that the land of Canaan, what's called today the Promised Land, would be a completely different environment than it was under the heathen who inhabited it before Israel came in. So he says we need to be careful how we live lest we suffer the same kind of fate. That's what he told Israel. So there is no question, no matter how kind and loving and helpful we want to be to people, there is no question that God says sin produces penalties, and in some cases national sins produce national penalties and always have. Certainly Israel's going into captivity was a case in point. So I just wanted to give you that comment and that background as we move now to Luke chapter 21. That was Leviticus. Luke chapter 21, to a scripture we're all, no doubt, much more familiar with and has been preached a great deal down through the 50 years I've been reading the scriptures, or more than that, actually. Luke 21, verse 34, but take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. So the scene shifts a little, but the principle is the same. Be careful how you live and how you conduct yourself, lest you be basically asleep when tragedy strikes, lest that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. So ultimately, the day of the Lord, or the end of the age, as we might put it in a more generalized setting, the end of the age and the day of the Lord will come upon you unexpectedly, and it will come upon everybody who dwells on the earth. Meaning, of course, that all nations are disobedient to God. Watch therefore, so here's the command for us. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass. When God says they will come to pass, remember he says all my counsel will stand, I will do all my pleasure. God is going to do it. It will come to pass. So when these things will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. Stand before, in our case, in the first resurrection, to be born into the family of God. And that's what he's talking about, not being crushed and obliterated by the sins of mankind and the penalties that God brings, but rather able to actually stand before the Son of God. So in this sense, he's saying, pray for yourself. You know, we pray for others, and we're supposed to, but we're also supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves, so we can also love and pray for ourselves. And in this case, he's saying, if you want to escape the terrible things that are coming and stand before Jesus Christ, then watch and pray. Now, there have been lots of interpretations over this down through the years, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail except to say that the word watch here in this case means to stay awake, to stay alert, not to sleep. It's pretty straightforward. Don't go to sleep on the job. Don't go to sleep at the switch, as we say. In this case, it's a pretty big switch. Don't go to sleep. Be alert. Watch. And of course, he says, and pray. So you watch and you pray always. And you're praying about lots of things, but he specifically points out here that you're praying that you yourself will be able to withstand the temptations and the trials and the troubles that come and actually be present when Christ returns. So it's a pretty big switch to go to sleep at. And none of us who have been called and given the opportunity to be God's family want to go to sleep on that job or at that switch. Now, the word watch develops into watching and watchmen and all of those different words, and I'm not going to go through those in a technical study here, but let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 33, because there is a there is a statement contained in the discussion between God and Ezekiel here that has some portent for us today, though again, the church, particularly in the last 30 years post Herbert W. Armstrong, the church has been a little hesitant to describe this in the same way that we used to, which is that it is specifically our responsibility. Yet there certainly is the possibility it's our responsibility, so we shouldn't go to sleep there either. But notice in Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 1, again, the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of your people and say to them, when I bring the sword upon the land. Notice, when I bring the sword upon the land, and the people of the land take a man from their territory and make him their watchman. So now this is a watchman, and this watchman, it's a little different. The term watch used for this lookout, you might say, is to peer into the distance, to look off down, you know, across the field and see what's coming, to see where the armies are, in that sense. So he says, the people of the land should take a man of their territory and make him a watchman. So you set a sentry of sorts, or a lookout. When he sees the sword coming upon the land, if he blows the trumpet and warns the people. So the job of the watchman is to look out there and see what's coming and then blow the trumpet and warn the people. Then whoever hears the sound of the trumpet and does not take warning, if the sword comes and takes him away, his blood shall be on his own head. Now, you might think that sounds harsh, but I heard that said by the governor of Florida this week. I heard it said by the mayor of Houston a couple of weeks ago. That is, if you stay behind when you're asked to evacuate, as Governor Scott said last night, if you stay behind, you're on your own, and we can't be responsible for you. That is, people, of course, who had the capacity to evacuate. There may have been some who didn't. But he was making the statement of as a warning that said, if you choose to stay here, your blood is on your own head. It's the same general statement. If you stay here, the first responders are not going to come see you for at least 72 hours. That's the terminology they were using. So you see, in other words, if you are warned, if you're told you must get out. Now, Florida, of course, had much more time in a sense than we did, because they know the storm was coming and have for days, in a different way than we knew about Harvey, which was going to go in down toward Corpus Christi. But they've been warned over and over. Now, some of our own people are not getting out. Some of my family is not getting out. Maybe some of your families are not getting out. All I'm saying is the principle is clear, and we know it even today in our modern vernacular. If you stay behind when we're ordered to evacuate, then the government and the city staff cannot be responsible for your life. It's as simple as that. But remember, this is an analogy of spiritual things to come, which we just read about it briefly in Luke 21. Verse 5, he heard the sound of the trumpet. Here's the problem. He heard the sound of the trumpet, which was a clear warning. They had a very clear signal for a warning. He heard the sound of the trumpet, but did not take warning. His blood shall be upon himself. But he who takes warning will save his life. So you're supposed to respond to warnings of imminent danger to the best of your ability. Even God himself says that here. But it goes on to say in verse 6, but if the watchman sees the sword coming and does not blow the trumpet, if the lookout goes to sleep on the job and does not blow the trumpet, the people are not warned, and the sword comes and takes any person from among them. He is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at the watchman's hand. Okay, fair enough, right? He was put there to do a specific job, and he didn't do it. In fact, if you think about it, it could wipe out 10,000 people because he didn't blow the trumpet, and God is only taking his life in return. So if you want to talk about a fairness, in a sense, the investment here is, I can blow the trumpet and save my life, and if people are on their own. Or I can go to sleep at the job and not blow the trumpet, and if somebody dies, I'm going to die too. Now, the church has always had to look at this from the standpoint of how we preach the gospel, how we proclaim the warning of God to the world, and to people, of course, who themselves have to then be willing to listen. They can hear the sound of the trumpet and ignore it. And millions have. You know, when we were preaching the gospel at a tremendously high level of saturation in this country, in Canada, at one time, the Plain Truth magazine was in one of every 9 homes in the nation of Canada. Here in America, it was more like 20 or so. But at any rate, people were hearing the message, but they weren't paying attention. Now, God judges them and when and how they have that opportunity. Perhaps none of them were really being called at that time. I'm not here to say that. The point is that the message has to go out, and it's up to people to respond or not respond to the message. But if we don't preach the message to the best of our ability, if we are the watchman. Now, that's a variable, isn't it? God can set a watchman or several watchmen or whatever he chooses to do, and I am not taking for us that responsibility. But God's church surely, in part, is responsible for preaching the gospel, as Christ clearly told the disciples to do. So we make an attempt to do that. We try to do what we're given to do. Verse 7 says, "So you, O son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel." So in this case, Ezekiel was a prophet who was set aside to warn Israel. And again, we try to apply that in an analogy sense to the spiritual responsibility of the church today in how we proclaim the truth and warn the world that the end of the age is going to come and man could be caught unawares. Now, let's go to Isaiah chapter 21, where this same concept is mentioned again and a slightly different statement is made. Isaiah chapter 21, verse 6. Here it's not put in the context of the trumpet the same way. It says in verse 6, "For thus has the Eternal said to me, go set a watchman. Let him declare what he sees." Now it goes on to give the story, but I want to make the point that he says, set a watchman and let him declare what he sees. And again, we know that clearly if we do see, then we are supposed to say. We don't always see. God doesn't always reveal to us exactly what he's doing, when he's doing it. Sometimes we don't know until afterward. But if God chooses to tell us and reveals it to us, and God has the secret things that he can reveal if he chooses, but if he reveals them to us, then we have a responsibility to do something about them. It says, if you see it, then you should declare what you see. So that's the approach we try to take in investing in doing the work of preaching the gospel, whether it's in person, whether it's in print, whether it's on the web, wherever it might be. In Psalm 127, if you can get past 119, 127 will pop up really quickly. Psalm 127, verse 1. Here's a spiritual principle for us to keep in mind. This apparently comes from Solomon. Verse 1, "Unless the Eternal builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." So in other words, what man does is temporary. It's of no real value unless God is in it. I have a very good friend who always made the statement, if God's not in it, I don't want any part of it. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." But notice the rest. "Unless the Eternal guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." Oh, so the watchman can stay awake and even do his job, but if God decides to blot out the city, God's not going to hold the watchman responsible. If he stayed awake and warned people that something's about to happen. You know, that was Jonah's problem. That's a side I can't get too far off in, but think about it. Jonah went and warned Nineveh, and when Nineveh decided to hear the message and repent, Jonah got upset and frustrated because he thought it came back on him. He was some kind of a fake or a liar because God didn't blot out Nineveh. But that's God's judgment. God set Jonah as the watchman in that sense to go in and warn them, and he did his job. And he did not have to pay a penalty for that. He had to end up learning a lesson because he took it upon himself to think that it was his righteousness that was on the line. All right, sorry, back to Ezekiel chapter 3 this time. We'll go back to the beginning of the book where Ezekiel is being charged with his responsibility. Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 19. We'll break in here because it's similar to what we read in chapter 33, and you see how he says it here. Verse 19 of chapter 3. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. Again, when a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, I lay a stumbling block before him. Notice God's directly involved. I lay a stumbling block before him. He shall die. Because you did not give him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he has done shall not be remembered, but his blood I will require at your hand. So he says, even a righteous man, if he's not warned and drifts off into sin, is going to die, but you're going to pay for it. Verse 21, nevertheless, if you warn the righteous man, and the righteous should not sin, or that the righteous should not sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live because he took warning. Also, you have delivered your soul. So you see, it works best for everybody. If the watchman says what he's supposed to say and does what he's supposed to do, and if those who are the hearers of the watchman actually hear and react and respond. That, of course, is the prayer and the hope of every minister, every preacher, every speaker that walks up to this platform or any other one in the church. The hope is that if you have prepared something that you believe God needs the brethren to hear, that they will hear. And if it's a warning, that they will heed the warning and deliver themselves, and that the watchman then delivers himself by giving that warning. So God's made it clear that there is a responsibility both to warn and to hear the warning. And the hearing of the warning includes our own personal responsibility to watch. Because what are we watching? We're watching the watchman, in a sense. We're listening for the message. We're listening for the clear trumpet. And sometimes for us individually, that trumpet is right here. It comes directly out of God's word. We read the word and we say, wow, that applies to me. What do I do with this? And we respond. We react. We hear God's warning. We hear God's concern for us. And we accept that God is willing to guard the house. God is willing to build the house and guard the city, to use the proper analogy. Let's look at a companion, I think, scripture in Matthew chapter 10. I call it a companion not because it specifically uses the same terminology, but because we can see what Christ is telling his followers whom he sent out to preach the message. Matthew chapter 10. This context actually starts in verse 5, where he says, these 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, do not go into the way of the Gentiles, do not go in to enter a city of Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So he sent them to preach the gospel. That's a summary of it. And he tells them to heal and do all these things, and he tells them to depend completely upon him. We come all the way down through the story. And to verse 12, and when you go into a household, greet it. If the household is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. How do you suppose it was determined whether it was worthy or not? Not by whether they were righteous or not, but whether they received the messenger and said, yes, we want to hear what you have to say. Verse 14, and whoever will not receive you, nor hear your words. There's the key. Whoever will not receive you nor hear your words, when you depart from that house or city, shake off the dust from your feet. We read this a few weeks ago because I remember mentioning to you that the Jehovah's Witnesses still do that today. When they go up to a house and people say, no, don't want to hear you, have my own brand of religion or no religion at all or whatever, those representatives of the Jehovah's Witnesses will turn and somewhere on their way out of the house and down to the walk, they will stop and shake the dust off their feet in what they consider a fulfillment of this command. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. What do you see here? I see a parallel with what we've just been reading in Ezekiel and Isaiah that says if you have a watchman and you don't listen to him, and somebody suffers, it's going to depend on whether the watchman did his job or whether the individual heard the warning or not. And in this case, the disciples, in a sense, are acquitting themselves by shaking the dust off their feet, because the point was they had to say, yes, we did our job. Yes, we delivered the message, and they would not hear it, and then we shake the dust off our feet. So it's in a sense saying, God, I did my job. God, I performed what you sent me to do. But then he throws in that judgment. It'll be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah than that city that rejects the message. You see how serious that is to God? It's serious to God that the warning go out, and it's serious to God that the message be heard, not summarily rejected. Now, if we bought the theory, and I'm not suggesting we should, I did for many, many years. I'm not sure that I don't still, but that's my problem. If we accepted the theory that the gospel was preached in this country powerfully for decades so that millions upon millions of people heard it, but we have now only a handful of converted people responding to it, then we'd have to ask ourselves, has the nation rejected the message? Has the nation rejected the warning? I'm not talking about rejecting the name of Christ or rejecting the idea of Christianity, but rather rejecting the warning that our nation, because of sin, is going to suffer. Something to think about. I have no definitive answer for you. I'd just like you to think about the fact that Christ sent them out and told them, you go and warn, and if people don't hear, that's their problem. That's their problem, if you do your part. But you'd better do your part. We read that earlier. Chapter 26 of Matthew. Matthew 26. Matthew 26, verse 36. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, that'd be James and John, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. Now, the watch here is not the peering down the road to see where the enemy is. This watch is the same as the one in Luke chapter 21 that says watch and pray. It is to stay alert, to be awake, to watch what's happening, to know where you are, what you're doing, what your surroundings are, to be awake, to be alert. I don't have the parable of the 10 virgins in my notes today, but think about it for a moment. You know, they slumbered and slept, and when the time came to meet the bridegroom, they didn't have any oil in their lamps. Staying awake would have probably prevented them from running out of oil. Going on. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. So here Christ is facing the trauma of death and persecution and scourging and all the things he's about to face. And he's asking the disciples to stay awake and think about the seriousness of what he's about to face. In other words, to join with him in the process. Now, they weren't going to be sacrificed, and they weren't going to even understand it all, but he asked them to stay awake. Help me out here while I pray to God. He didn't take them into his prayer. He went a little further and knelt down and prayed. But he wanted them to be watching. He wanted them to be part of the process. He wanted them to be willing to do what they could do, which was not what he could do. Verse 40, then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. Sleeping, the opposite of watching. Watching is sleeplessness. Watching is alert. Watching is awake. he found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What, could you not watch with me 1 hour?" Christ has given 33 and a half years to this project without sin. And he says, "Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." See, actually, he was making the point and the lesson that they were physical, weak, frail human beings who were not committed to what he had been committed to, and that they were going to have to change their ways. This is really kind of a warning from Christ to the disciples that if they're going to follow him, they're going to have to be willing to do far more than just stay awake for an hour. They couldn't even stay awake for an hour. Now, admittedly, it had probably been a long, hard day, but they had to stay awake. I saw last night, yesterday evening, you may have seen it, they were talking to some of the folks over in Florida who had been here to rescue people during Harvey. I can't remember what group it was, but they were talking to this big, burly leader of the group. And he looked into the camera and he said, "Yes, I am tired. I'm very tired. I'd like to have some rest. But we've got to do what we got to do. And we're going to go do it." You know, he had been here rescuing people in Houston. He goes home to Florida to rest and he faces Hurricane Irma. He said, "Yeah, I'd like to have some rest. I am very tired." And he looked very tired. But he wasn't just going to go put his feet up and say, "I did my part in Houston." There have been some amazing examples, of course, of human effort, kindness, compassion, commitment, even of people who do not really always know and understand what God is doing. Again, a second time he went away and prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass from me unless I drink it, your will be done." So Christ is fervently committing himself to God's will. And he comes back, verse 43, came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. They were tired. They were sleepy. But Christ isn't giving them a pass at this point, but he does here. Verse 44, so he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words. He came to his disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up and go. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." He said, you guys have been sleeping through the critical moments of preparation for the crescendo of this entire event. We need to get up and go because the plan is moving forward with or without you. Back a couple of pages to chapter 24. We're in the Olivet prophecy here, of course, when Christ was asked what would be the sign of his coming and the end of the age, and he gave the long prophecy, which we frequently go through, including the four horsemen and the heavenly signs and all the various things, the tribulation, all the things that go through there. But in verse 42, having given them all of that, he says in verse 42, "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming." So the warning here is a pretty long-term, long-range general warning, isn't it? Christ is saying, watch and pray. You know, be your own watchman in a sense, because you don't know when the end is coming. Not only do you not know when the enemy is coming, you don't know when I'm coming to judge. So watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed the house to be broken into. So he gave them a common example, an analogy of somebody watching his own house and not letting a thief come in and take everything. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. So it's not a matter of just being awake for the first watch or the third watch. It's a matter of being awake all the time, spiritually awake we're talking about. We're not talking about going without sleep physically. We're talking about going without spiritual sleep, being alert, watching, being sleepless. Over to chapter 25. Chapter 25. He repeats this. Verse 13. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. So it's an ongoing, positive, constant responsibility to be paying attention to the circumstances. We have circumstances, as I said, all around us in the world today. I don't quite know how to analyze them. God hasn't revealed to us yet whether something special is happening. Not to me, anyway. God hasn't shown us whether we've turned a corner that is leading to America's ultimate decline, which is prophesied. God isn't telling us that yet. Maybe a series of circumstances will make it obvious. I've said many times, but God said, Christ told us to watch for the abomination of desolation to be set up in Jerusalem. And we do, except we don't know what it is. I mean, we think we know. We know some of the conditions, and we know Jerusalem's going to be surrounded by armies, so we're going to get some clues as we go along. But sometimes our watching is watching in a broad, general, awake sense, looking for the clues, listening for the trumpet, waiting to see what's actually going to happen and what God is actually doing. We know from the book of Job and other places that Satan the devil himself has the power to send a hurricane and wipe out a city or a state. We don't know whether that's what's happening. We don't know whether it's a combination of simply the natural forces that God put in motion that have perhaps been disrupted by humanity and our way of life and our building and our pollution and all of those things. We don't know. When God wants us to know, we need to be alert enough to hear and be able to recognize what God is showing us. 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4, I've known people down through 50 years in the ministry who can get very excited about prophecy and get into all kinds of measurements and calendars and all of these things about prophecy. And that can be fun. I've done it myself. Sit down and draw the charts and try to put all the pieces together, put the scriptures together, and figure out how it all comes out. Of course, we know the ultimate result. We just don't always know all the steps. We can miss one little step and miss the whole point. So Peter tells us that once we are awake and see that all these things are going on around us, there's a purpose that we ought to also fulfill. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 7. But the end of all things is at hand, therefore be serious and watchful in your prayers. Now, Peter said the end of all things are at hand in his day. We'll come back to his other comment that I mentioned earlier about the responsibility that we have. But he gives it to us here as be watchful and be serious. Now, it doesn't mean you're serious all the time in the sense that you go around with a hangdog expression. You go around with a hopelessness or a pessimism or a worry and a fear. He also tells us not to be anxious about tomorrow, not be overly concerned about things we can't control. But he does tell us to be serious and watchful. And in that, part of the fruit of that is, next verse, above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. So he doesn't just say be watchful, he says be doing something. In this case, outgoing concern and love and care for one another in whatever way we have opportunity and means to express that. And different people have different talents, different skills, different abilities. I've talked with my son Randall a bit about their hospice program, and most of you are familiar with that idea of helping people to go through the end stages of life in a more meaningful, dignified, comfortable way. You know, they have lots of nurses on the staff, but they have other people, including even musicians, who come in and sit down and pick a guitar and play, sing, or they play a piano, or whatever it is they do. They do things that are restorative. They do things that are comforting. They do things that are encouraging to serve one another. In other words, some people can invite 20 people to dinner and be totally comfortable with that. Other people are more likely to go in and say, can I clean your bathroom for you? And, you know, there's a whole range of things that can happen. And you might even go in and play the piano, you know, if somebody has one. The point is that there are different ways to serve and to love one another and do the things that we need to do. The next one says, be hospitable to one another without grumbling. And again, there's an attitude involved, you see. It's not just doing it because it has to be done, but it's without grumbling. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. So he's saying that we should watch, and in watching, we should respond according to our ability to respond and our particular talents. Back to the book of Job, Job 24. Job asks an interesting question here, which he frequently does, and this is Job speaking at this point. Job 24, verse 1. It's kind of a question we're asking today, in a sense. Job 24, verse 1. This applies to you and me directly, in a sense, and yet I can't fully answer the question. Maybe you can. 24:1, since times are not hidden from the Almighty, God knows what's happening and when. Since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know him not see his days? Or see not his days, it says in this one. Since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know him see not his days? If God knows, how come we don't know? That's what Job is asking. Well, of course, there is an answer in a sense. That is, the secret things belong to God, and until God reveals them, we don't always know them. Just like he told his disciples there were some things he wasn't going to tell them because they belonged to his Father. Some things we don't know and can't know. Some things that we don't know, though, we need to know when the time comes, and so what do? We stay awake. We watch. We look. We consider, we take in the information and process it and figure, what does this mean for me? What does God want from me? What's going to be my condition when the time comes? If God knows the times, how come we don't know them? That's what Job is asking. Isaiah 29. I have this in my notes, but I honestly can't remember what it says. So let's go find out. Isaiah chapter 29. Isaiah 29, the title of the section is called The Blindness of Disobedience, so it should tell us. Verse 9, pause and wonder, blind yourselves and be blind. They are drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with intoxicating drink. It's not a physical thing, in other words. For the Eternal has poured out on you the spirit of deep sleep. This is Israel, and Isaiah is saying to them, God has poured out on you the spirit of deep sleep and has closed your eyes, namely the prophets. The prophets have gone to sleep. And he has covered your heads, namely the seers. The whole vision has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one who is literate, saying, read this, please. And he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. So he's literate. He's supposed to be able to read, but you give him the book and he says, it's sealed. I can't read it. What it really means is I can't understand it. I don't know what it says. Then the book is delivered to one who is illiterate, saying, read this, please. Now, there you go. That's man's solution to the problem, right? It's delivered to somebody who's literate and he says, I can't read it. Oh, take it to the illiterate guy. That's what it says. They take the book to the illiterate guy and give it to him. Ask him to read it. And the illiterate person says, I am not literate. Okay. Therefore the Lord said, inasmuch as these people draw near with their mouths and honor me with their lips, but have removed their hearts far from me. See, there's the problem. They can't hear God's words. What did Christ say? You do not hear. You don't understand because you will not hear me. Their fear toward me is taught by the commandment of men. Therefore, behold, I will again do a marvelous work among this people. A marvelous work and a wonder, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hidden. It's not going to be about human wisdom and human experience and human understanding. It's going to be about God's revelation and God's ability to show us what we need to know. Our job is to be ready for it. Our job is to be vessels that can receive what God gives us. Not people who've either made up our minds that we already know the answer, or people who are asleep because we have given our lives over to other priorities and issues, or people who say, that's not convenient for me right now. I heard the trumpet sound, but I can't get out of here. God says he will take care of it, and he will. Back to Matthew chapter 11. Here Christ says it not to ancient Israel, but to contemporary Israel when he walked the earth, as well as, in a sense, to his disciples and to all of us, those who will hear his words. Matthew chapter 11. After talking about John the Baptist, at verse 12, he says, from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force, meaning that it's going to take energy and force and power and faith and confidence to be a part of God's kingdom. Verse 13, for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. If you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is to come. Then he says this, which he said in very many different places. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So again, it's not the physical hearing that he's talking about. It's the capacity to hear and understand. He goes on in verse 16 to point that out. But to what shall I liken this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to their companions and saying, we played the flute for you and you did not dance. We mourned to you and you did not lament. He says they have a preconceived idea of what things should be and how to go about it, but they're not aware of the real issues. John came neither eating nor drinking, and they said he has a demon. So people draw their conclusions based on their perspective and their experience, not on what God does. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look, a glutton and a wine bibber. Here we go again. It's like the literate and the illiterate. They said, John has got a demon because, you know, he doesn't eat, he doesn't drink. Locusts and wild honey. We'd call that weird today, wouldn't we? But Christ came, eating and drinking, being normal, and they said, he's a wine bibber and a glutton. But wisdom is justified by her children. What he means by that is the fruits. The fruits will prove what the purpose of their eating and drinking was about. This is a spiritual analogy. He went on at the end of that context to say, you know, same, and you hear it on the last great day, you will hear it. Maybe I should read it here. He went on to say, let me look for it really quickly. Oh, I was in 11, forgot where I was. He went on to say, woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida. We hear this on the last great day almost every year. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. So you see, he's saying, hear and do something about it. When you hear, you have to respond. That's what Christ's message is, over and over again. Chapter 13. Chapter 13, start in verse 10, where you're explaining about the parables, and you've all heard this before. The disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered and said to them, because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. So here he explains that the parables are to cloud the meaning, not to clarify it. For whoever has, to him more will be given, he will have abundance, but whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see. They're not awake, they're not alert. Hearing they do not hear. Nor do they understand. And in them, the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says. So now he takes an ancient prophecy and brings it forward to his time. And he says, the prophecy of Isaiah says, hearing you will hear and shall not understand. Seeing you will see and not perceive. Then he goes on to explain why that happens. It's not just that they're cut off. It is verse 15, for the hearts of this people have grown dull. They had the truth at one time. Their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn so that I should heal them. He says, that's not part of the process. That's not part of the plan. They are cut off, and they have no real interest in changing their approach. They're asleep at the switch, as we said. They are have closed their eyes. They are too lethargic to pay attention, to be alert. And to certainly participate as a watchman, not only for themselves, but for others. They're not doing it. Writing this down, I couldn't help but remember something I thought was very funny, but I always try to tell a funny story and it never works. But I'll tell you this one anyway. Some of you country folk will get it. I saw a little clip from the old Hee Haw show. How many of you remember Hee-Haw? The older folks will. Maddox says, Hee-Haw, what's that? Hee-Haw. I'll tell you, your dad can tell you later. I saw a little clip of Hee-Haw. And Junior Samples, who was kind of the, you know, the big ignorant guy who, when they asked him what he'd been doing one day, he said, I just got finished painting the cow blue. And that was his big deal for the day. So that's Junior's personality. So in this skit, Junior's kind of lounging on a bale of hay, got his overalls on, he's lounging on a bale of hay, piece of straw hanging out of his teeth. And just across from him on the, not a bale of hay, but a pile of hay, on the other pile, side of the pile of hay is this other hillbilly, obviously, as they're termed there. And he's looking the other direction, and he's in a similar state, a little bit younger than Junior, probably, and he says, you won't believe what's coming up the road. Junior said, well, what is it? And he said, there is the finest looking young woman I have ever seen coming up the road, and she's got on short shorts and high-heeled shoes, and she got her hair all done up, and she is something to look at. And Junior says, sure wish I was a-looking that away. Now that's motivation. He couldn't bear to move to see the sight that he sure would like to see. That's being asleep at the switch. 2 Peter chapter 3. Yes, I have more scriptures today than usual. I apologize for that in one sense, although you'd probably rather hear the scriptures. So let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3. Let me see here. Verse 7, 2 Peter 3, 7. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, that is God's sustaining power, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and the perdition, that's the destruction, of ungodly men. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is a day. God's got all the time in the world. He's not trying to keep on our schedule. Verse 9, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Going on. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Now that's the long-term result of the day of the Lord. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, since all the prophecies that God has strung out through the Bible, and all the words of Jesus himself, are going to come to pass, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness. See, the whole point of the prophecies given to us today and the understanding of what's happening in the world and what is going to happen in the world, whether it happens as a result of the great catastrophes taking place in our country today or whether it doesn't happen until most of us are dead and gone. When it happens, we want to be counted worthy to escape all of those things. We want to be judged to have been awake and alert. We don't want either our blood or anybody else's blood on our hands. We want to be alert, watching, declaring what we see, understanding the conditions in which we live. Let's continue in this in the context. What manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? In other words, prophecy is about what we do with it. Prophecy is about how it motivates us to change our lives. It's about how it makes us realize we're temporary, physical, flesh and blood human beings here who are going to have to go and be blotted out one day. So what comes after that? Eternal death or eternal life? Looking for. Ah, there's that word again. Watching. Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. So Peter says, look, yes, tough times are coming. And as I've said before, if we're going to pray for the kingdom of God to come, we've got to be prepared for the interim. We've got to be prepared for what precedes the coming of Christ. What precedes the Feast of Tabernacles? We've got to be prepared for the tribulation. We've got to be prepared for what mankind is going to go through. And we've got to be asking God to give us the strength to get through it or to save us from it, whichever the case may be. I'm sure I'd prefer the latter. I'd rather be saved from it than saved through it. But that's God's decision and God's judgment. And perhaps some of mine in terms of how I watch and how I pray and how I look. I don't mean how I look. I mean how I look down the road. How I look out. How I watch. Nevertheless, we according to his promise look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. In other words, it's all going to come out proper in the end, right? It's all going to be according to God's will, and God is going to do his thing. Go back to Old Testament, to Amos chapter 3 for a moment. Amos chapter 3. I hope we believe this and I hope we have confidence in it. I have to. Amos chapter 3. God says he's a good watchman and he will take care of what needs to be taken care of. Chapter 3 verse 6. If a trumpet is blown in a city, will not the people be afraid? If there is calamity in a city, will not the Eternal have done it? Well, there again, these are specific circumstances. I don't know that God is always doing it, but it's saying here, if the trumpet's blown and there's a warning given and then it comes to pass, well, God's been involved. Verse 7, surely the Eternal God does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. Now, we don't have prophets today, per se. God hasn't at least revealed any to us and hasn't named any for us. We do have the church. We do have ministers. We do have leaders. We have people to whom God can reveal whatever he chooses to reveal. I'm not looking for some announcement to come out of Allen in the next 6 weeks saying it's the end of the age. You know, it's probably not going to be quite so cut and dried as that. But I would be looking for God to begin to show the church through whatever circumstances and the understanding of certain scriptures and the visions that he can provide to begin to see where we are in the time of the end, where we are in prophecy and when the time of the end is upon us. I believe God will allow that along with us watching so that we do recognize the abomination of desolation when it stands in the holy place. Finally, Psalm 121. I want to conclude here because it should be comforting and helpful to remember this, though we all certainly know it, and we sing the hymn from time to time. Psalm 121. Verse 1, I will lift up my eyes to the hills from which comes my help. My help comes from the Lord, the Eternal, who made heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. No, God isn't going to go to sleep. Behold, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. He who keeps Israel. See, he's on the job. He's protecting. He's providing. The Eternal is your keeper. The Eternal is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Eternal shall preserve you from all evil. He shall preserve your soul. The Eternal shall preserve your going out and your coming in, from this time forth and even forevermore. Nice to have that promise when the world is in chaos, when even our own commentators are saying the country is ravaged by disasters. It's good to know that God is still in charge, that God knows what we need, and that God will deliver the goods. God is our keeper, and God will provide.